We'd just like to bring Pierre up right now. Sorry. Dr. Steinberg.
Pierre.
We're friends, and it's hard to call you that. Anyway, you have a couple of doctorates, but your real day job is head of HR for the conference, right? And you're also a family counselor. What else am I missing? I told him that I asked him to tell me his deepest secret so I could share it with everybody, and he just smiled. So.
Just Pierre.
All right, thank you.
Good afternoon. Usually I have a whole weekend, and I do 5-6 sessions of 2 or so hours each. I have never attempted this in an hour and a half. So I've decided that I'm not going to follow any particular theme or anything. I'm just going to give you 8 or 9 tips and leave it at that. So choose whatever works for you. And if it doesn't, just enjoy the afternoon with us. But I'll just share just some tips to hopefully increase the health and the happiness of relationships. Many people misunderstand what marriage and relationships are all about. But just look at the word relationship. Relationship is all about how we relate. We often think that relationships and relational trouble is because of finances or the mother-in-law or the children and those type of things. And yes, when there's a blended family, over half of them will state that the marital problems have to do with disciplining each other's kids. About 45% of divorces state finances as one of the main reasons. And the list goes on. But really, if we come to think of it, relationships are about how we relate. They're not about the finances. Finances are neutral. They don't have the power to make or break your relationship. They really don't have any power at all to even influence your relationship. And so for all these other things, because it's all about how you relate. The bottom line is very simple. It's how you treat each other. And I'm going to share some stuff with you that hopefully opens your eyes and reprograms your mind this afternoon as we go along. Before I start with the tips and things, I would like to share with you that marriage is absolutely awesome. A happy marriage is heaven on earth. And I don't mean that lightly. And actually, it's not me that says so. I'm going to show you a quote in a minute. But a happy marriage is just absolutely wonderful. God knew what He was doing when He created marriage. Because there's nothing like marriage that fulfills your life, brings joy. You have somebody to just share everything with. It is absolutely wonderful. So just very shortly, there's been numerous academic studies, but it's been proven that happy marriages equates to greater life satisfaction. Not just with marriage, but with life. Secondly, it leads to greater societal well-being. In society as general, the happier the marriage is, the better that society is. They have more sex. And for an Adventist audience, this is a strange thing to say. But let's take it to the non-Adventist context outside, where everybody just lives together and sleep together, right? And you'd think that those who are not married that sleep together in a committed relationship have equal access to those who are married and live together. But yet, research and statistics tell us very plainly, and this is secular research, that those who are married have more sex than those who just live together in a relationship. Not only that, but they actually find the sex more satisfying than those who just live together. There's something deeper. And it's just more fulfilling. Not just on a physical level, but on a relational, a deep level as well. People who are married live longer than those who are not. statistically significantly so. They're also, they're healthier. In fact, research shows that when you have a group of close friends that support you no matter what, you recover quicker from surgeries and all sorts of illnesses. It really impacts your life in a major way. And then, of course, you also have more money. People who are married have more money than those that just live together. And the reason for that is, even though the income is the same, the one, when God says two shall become one, pool things together, they plan together, they work together, they share resources, etc. It's not my money and your money, it's our money. Whereas if you're different and you just live together, there's my money and your money, and then I've got my expenses and your expenses, and sometimes those expenses get doubled because we sometimes do the same thing. By the way, the only difference between people that live together and people who are married is one little word called commitment. And that word has a huge impact on the relationship by itself. I have an entire long lecture on why living together and having premarital sex is a problem from a scientific point of view. But I don't see many young people here, so I'll skip that today. Remember I said that a happy marriage is a little bit of heaven on earth? Not me saying so. This comes from the little book In Heavenly Places, written by E.G. White. Look at what it says. The warmth of true friendship and the love that binds the hearts of husband and wife are a foretaste of... It's not me saying so. The inspired pen. And so marriage is really just a beautiful thing. God has ordained that there should be perfect love and perfect harmony between those who enter into the marriage relation. That bride and bridegroom, in the presence of the heavenly universe, pledge themselves to love one another as God has ordained they should. So what is the marriage pledge? What are you pledging? Right, you see, there's a fundamental mind shift change that needs to happen, because most people always ask, what's in it for me? When most people get involved, whether it's business or work or church or whatever, I'll do whatever you ask me to do, but what's in it for me? What benefit do I get? Marriage is actually the reverse. Marriage is not about what you get. It's about what you can give. Marriage is about you pledging to love your spouse. Period. Not because of what I can get back. Now, of course, if your spouse does the same, it will be reciprocal. And you will get back. But that's not the motive. A happy marriage is a foretaste of heaven. God ordained it for us to love one another. Here comes the first step. Change yourself, not your spouse. Most people, when they start in marriage, try and change the spouse. If only you'd be like this, we'd be happy. If only you'd stop doing that, we'll be happy. Well, first of all, that places the blame elsewhere instead of owning anything yourself. But here's the fact. Psychologically speaking, none of us have the power to change anybody else like the way we want them to be. You don't have that power. Now, psychologically speaking, all relationships impact us and does change us. But you can't pick and choose and say to begin with, I'm going to make you such and such. I'm going to change you this way. It doesn't work that way. And many marriages break up simply because they try and change each other and make them like themselves. And it just doesn't work. You only have power to change you. Right? With God's help, you can change. But you can't fashion and mold your spouse the way you want her or you want him. Forget this concept of trying to change them. Let me tell a little secret. When people get divorced, they get divorced because, of course, it's not their fault. The other person does such and such and such and such and such and such, and that's the reason for divorce. And I'm not belittling divorce. People go through horrendous things. So I'm not laughing at that. As you'll see later on, even Mrs. White say that some marriages is just laden with misery. But be that as it may, you cite the other person has done all these things to you and is such a terrible person, etc. And then 2-3 years down the line, you find Mrs. or Mr. Perfect. And you marry that person. And then when psychologists do research, guess what they find? 60% of them marry the same type of person as they just left. So be careful to want to change other people. Once again, Mrs. White writes in Advent Home, those who are not willing to adapt themselves to each other's disposition so as to avoid unpleasant differences and contentions should not take the step, speaking of marriage. If you're not willing to adapt yourself to your spouse, don't get married. It does not say adapt your spouse. It's saying you adapt, you change to fit into your spouse's disposition and so forth. So the main thing is change yourself. If you're struggling and having issues, take that to the Lord and pray that He changes you rather than wanting to change her. Because the whole concept of marriage is you adapt, you change. You change to your spouse. Now, of course, this is in the context of normalcy and believing moral. It's not saying that if your spouse does something immoral that you should adapt to that. It's not saying that if your wife beats you up every day that you should adapt to change to that. This is within the context of a normal Christian home. I'll read you one more, and I know it speaks, it taps us men more in the wrist than women, but I'm sure it applies both ways. She says in Review and Herald, February 2, 1886, paragraph 6, she says, frequently a man who is entirely ignorant of the wants of one of the opposite sex and the treatment she should deserve takes her under his proposed protection, with his influence and his temperament, are to her a desolating hail, beating down her will and her aspirations, and leaving her no freedom of mind or judgment. Ignoring her personal rights, he becomes unkind and authoritative. Her individuality is lost in his, and she becomes a slave. Look, all I can say is, change yourself. She makes many other statements that when we are married, we become one, but we never lose our identity within the marriage. It should be okay for my wife to have her interests and for me to have my interests. And of course, we'll have common interests as well. But because I love photography doesn't mean that she's got to be a photographer. And we're going to have a lot of common friends. But it's also no problem if she's got a few friends and I've got a few friends. Obviously, we all need to get along, etc. But there needs to be room for this marriage to work and for the relationships to be happy and healthy. And all marriage, all relationships, whether it's marriage or not, even your co-workers at work, doesn't matter, your kids, all marriages move and get closer and further apart. All the time. Sometimes you're closer to each other and sometimes you're a little bit further away and you're always moving. And as long as that movement is in a narrow band, you're okay and healthy. It's when it goes way out that you've got issues. But it's totally normal for you guys to retain who you are as a person. Yes, things are going to rub off. Yes, the relationship is going to impact and change and shape and mold you guys. But you don't forcefully do so. Allow room for each other to be who God wanted them to be. Because let's face it, if you change your spouse to be somebody he or she is not, they will not be happy. They will not be fulfilled. You're asking them to pretend whom they're not. Tip number two. How we fight causes more harm than that over which we fight. This is huge. This is a huge, huge concept. Think about it. So I get home. I'm making this up, by the way. My wife would never do this. I get home and I find out my wife has just spent, made $5,000 worth of debt to buy whatever, something we don't need. So now all of a sudden we have problems. We start fighting and eventually erupts into a huge fight. We don't do this. I'm just making this up. We have a huge fight. And after the fight, when anybody asks us, what was that yelling and screaming about? What are you guys fighting about? What are we going to say? It's about money. Right? Now, if somebody asks me, why am I mad at her? Well, she spent our money. If somebody asks her, what was this fight about? What is she going to say? Now, yeah, okay, maybe I'm stingy. But here comes the deal. Here comes the deal. The research shows that it's not just the act itself of spending the money without consultation or whatever else that causes relational harm. It's how we fight. So I'd like a very brave, brave couple to come and join me. One brave couple. And before you decide, here's the question I'm going to ask you. I'm going to ask you for the topic of some little tiff or argument that you had. Do I have a couple? No. Nobody's brave enough. Okay, I can do it without a couple. It's okay. So, during the fight, we fight, and here's the deal. If we were to press the pause button in the middle of the fight and we would freeze right where we are, and a counselor would step in and go to the wife and say to her, how do you now feel? What is she going to say? Attacked, angry, ignored, not listened to, neglected, whatever else. Now, what have those things got to do with the money? We press the play button, the fight continues and ends. When the fight is over, you press the pause button. You go to the husband. How do you now feel? What's going on inside of you? And he will tell you the same things. How they're feeling has nothing to do with money. It has to do with how we related. Not just in the fight, but what built up to it and so forth. That's what causes relational damage. How we fight, more so than what we fight over. This is a huge concept to understand. It is how you relate, how you treat each other, that changes everything. You're welcome to say what you need to say, as long as you say it respectfully and kindly and so forth. And you'll preserve the relationship and solve whatever needs to be solved. But it is how we treat each other in the fight that causes the harm, not necessarily just what we fight over. And many people, when they go to divorce court, cite all these topics of the fights as the cause of the breakup, when that's not really it. Many millions of couples also don't have finances, etc., etc., and the same thing happened, they didn't break up. It's how they treat each other that causes the difference. And let me just say that in the last 30, 40 years, research on the reasons for divorce have become extremely difficult to do from a scholarly, psychological perspective, because starting about 40 years back, nobody anymore on divorce papers state the real reasons why they're getting divorced. Almost 90-whatever percent of them simply state irreconcilable differences. And these court records were the major source for research on divorce. Well, then they all state the same thing. However, since the advent of a tiny little company by the name of Google, all of a sudden, search terms are accessible to anybody to research. And you can search for what people search for. And you can find what couples search for. And the way they phrase their questions, you can even deduce accurately what gender they are, and et cetera, and see what troubles they're going through. And the bottom line is, people don't get divorced because of the kids or because of money, et cetera. It's because they feel neglected, abused, not listened to, disrespected, contempt. How we relate. Now, let me share with you. Don't know why this thing's so slow. There are numerous topics, academic studies that have studied this type of thing. This particular study was a longitudinal study over 16 years. They met with the couple in year 1, year 3, year 5, year 7, and then again in year 16. And they have found, number one, that criticism and yelling was one of the greatest predictors of divorce. How you fight, not the topics. Secondly, on the opposite spectrum of that, withdrawal and cold shouldering is an equal predictor of divorce. Now, which gender do you think specializes in which behavior? Now, I ask that question because I'm beginning to set you up for something to come. Notice how quickly you answered without even thinking. Based upon what did you formulate your answer? Own experience, and basically from stereotypes. I'm going to shock you a little bit later today with stereotypes. But I'm busy setting you up for that. We'll get there. Once again, Advent Home, E.G. White. Do not try to compel each other to do as you wish. That speaks to the previous tip. Change yourself, don't try and change them. But it goes on. You cannot do this and retain each other's love. Manifestations of self will destroy the peace and happiness of the home. Let not your married life be one of contention. If you do, you will both be unhappy. Now, here comes the moral of the story. Be kind in speech and gentle in action, giving up your own wishes. Now, it sounds terrible, but it's not if both of you do it, right? Because if your spouse does it as well, then you are going to get some of the things you want because she's going to give that up. And vice versa. If it's reciprocal, there's no problem with this. So, watch well your words, for they have a powerful influence for good or for ill. Allow no sharpness to come into your voice. What is she talking about? The manner in which we relate. The manner in which we speak, the manner in which we argue and fight. It ought not to be a fight because you're going to be kind. You're going to be giving up. You're going to put the other person first. Bring into your united life the fragrance of Christ-likeness. One more. Advent Home, page 83, paragraph 4. By contention over trivial matters, a bitter spirit is cultivated. Open disagreements and bickering bring inexpressible misery into the home and drive asunder those who should be united in the bonds of love. what happens is psychological pain is cumulative. The only way for me to explain it to you easily is to walk myself into the chair and get myself all bruised up. So now I have a big blue bruise on my leg. So tomorrow, my wife comes and says, "Hi, honey," and she taps me on the leg. Now, how much pain am I feeling? I'm feeling lots of pain because she is tapping on a spot that has previous hurt. The hurt is cumulative from the injury and the pat. Psychologically, we're exactly the same. When we get hurt, there's a little place in your heart that now has a blue little wound. It's sore. The next time he or she hurts you on the same topic, it's tapping and poking that same spot. And the pain you feel surpasses that which that little incident causes, because you're now feeling pain not just from this incident, but from the major injury. And sometimes it's not a major injury. Sometimes it's just ongoing poking all the time until eventually, over time, you don't even know where it came from, but eventually you have this big blue lump on your heart. And whenever that little space is poked, there's an explosion. Just like when she tapped me, I go, "Ouch!" Well, my reaction was disproportionate to what she did. But it's not disproportionate to the latent pain that is hidden there in that wound. That's how relationships work and psychology work with past wounds. And so what happens is the way we treat each other begins to hurt a little bit. And every time you hurt in that same topic, it gets deeper and deeper and worse and worse. And eventually, it just takes a little touch and you explode. Because it's in the same topic. Why? Because you're experiencing the pain accumulative over the time. So, when we end up with these wounds, the littlest little touch on that place, and you've got a volcano erupting. That's the reason why people start fighting, bickering over trivial stuff. It seems trivial, but it's because you've been hurt so many times in that same topic that it's just the last straw on the camel's back. So, be careful to not bicker, disagree, trivial matters, etc. Do the opposite and just, you're welcome to say what you need to say. Topics need to be addressed, but we do so kindly. No sharpness in the voice, etc., etc. And then, Review and Herald, once again, self-denial must be practiced in the home. Every member of the family should be kind and courteous and should studiously seek by every word and act to bring in peace, contentment, and happiness. These are the three reasons why we should do what we do. Everything we do should be motivated out of this. Would this bring peace, contentment, and happiness to my spouse? One quick little text. Pleasant words are like a honeycomb, sweet to the soul and health to the bones. The point is a major point. How we fight is more important than what we fight about. It's how we treat each other that causes relational damage more so than what we did or what we fight about. Next up, work on your marriage. Before you got married, you worked on your relationship, didn't you? You drove miles. You were willing to make yourself bankrupt. Name it, you did it all. You worked at the relationship. Get married, and you want to put a button. It doesn't work. Marriage needs to be worked on. You need to invest time. You need to invest in the relationship. Now, men, let me just tell you, one of the biggest desires of your woman's heart is emotional intimacy. For you to connect to them. For you to just listen to them. I know it's not fully possible, but yes, even to attempt to understand them. Now, I know men, it really is impossible. We men cannot understand, fully understand ladies. It's not possible. It really is not. But let me tell you, if you attempt to understand your wife, the emotional intimacy that she feels skyrockets, whether you understand her or not. And so you need to work on the marriage and invest in the marriage. Ladies, just like men might find it very difficult to just sit there and listen to every detail, please also understand that men have different needs, and that actually drains them. And so when they're really tired and had a bad day at work, etc., you ladies don't understand the mental energy required by a man to do that. A man's batteries actually gets recharged by a cave experience, not by engaging. And so there needs to be a give and take where, if that's the case, give him a bit of space to go and sit in front of the computer or do whatever he wants to do. But gentlemen, please know that when you do that, she suffers because she has a need to connect. And vice versa. Ladies, please understand that when you want to connect like that, when he's tired, he's suffering. And so there needs to be a give and take where we do this based upon who's more tired, and etc. And gentlemen, when you take your cave experience, it's not all night because she's suffering. She wants you. So it's all about working on your marriage. Self-sacrifice. That's what's required. Send her little texts. Call her. Do those type of things. Buy her flowers for no reason at all, simply because you thought of her. Work on your marriage. Not me, E.G. White, Advent Home. Love is a plant of heavenly growth. Now, what does that tell you right there? It must be fostered and nourished. Affectionate hearts, truthful, loving words will make happy families. Now, this touches on the previous point as well, right? And exert an elevating influence upon all who come within the sphere of their influence. Your marriage is like a plant. It dies if it's not watered and nourished and taken care of. And certain plants need sunshine. Certain plants need shade. Certain plants need more water than others, etc. But you need to give the plant what it needs. You need to work at the relationship. It's not an autopilot marriage. It's never as happy and fulfilling as a marriage where you're working on it. Next tip. It's not about you. It's about your spouse. When you are self-focused, your marriage will have problems. Change the mindset. Focus on the spouse. It's all about him or her. Not about you. It's not about what you can get. It's what you give. I have a favorite statement in marriage that I always say, seek first to understand before you seek to be understood. What do we do when we fight? You try and persuade the other one your point of view. You're trying to justify what you said or what you did. What if we reverse that? It's not about you. Understand why she's mad. Understand how she feels. Focus on the spouse. Seek first to understand before you seek to be understood. So one of the favorite things that I do in marriage counseling with couples is you have a couple sit and face each other. Their knees touch. They hold hands. They look each other in the eye. They've just had a major fight. They're upset at each other. No argument about who's at fault. No argument about blame, justification, nothing like that. But one person simply asks questions to understand how the other one feels and what the other one's going through. In a safe environment, you don't ask questions such as, well, is it fair of you to feel that way? You don't ask those type of questions. Tell me what's going on in your heart. Tell me about your hurt. You seek to understand. And then later on you flip it. And she'll do the same to you. By understanding how the other person feels, what's going on, by experiencing the pain you see on their face, you hear in their voice, you see in their tears, it changes you. By the end of it, you're in no mood to fight. It really changes everything. This is what she says. Early writings, 120, paragraph 1. If pride, oh, by the way, the context of this is actually not marriage. The context of this is church fights. Church fights where people pick some minute thing that has nothing to do with salvation and build an entire castle on this nonsense and then is mad at everybody else that they're not holy enough to agree with that, etc. Just Thursday, someone told me of a family member that belongs to a church that some of the elders, when they go to church board, take firearms with them. I have personally heard of fist fights taking place at church boards. I have personally heard of the police being called to break up issues at church. It's that type of situation that she's addressing in this quote. Not marriage, to be fair. But the same principle applies. Look at what she says. If pride and selfishness were laid aside, 5 minutes will remove most difficulties. She goes on. Angels have been grieved and God displeased by the hours which have been spent in what? What do we do 90% of the time when we fight? We justify ourselves. It's not about you. It's about your spouse. When you justify yourself, it's all about you. Focus on the spouse. On the spouse's needs. On why they feel the way they do, etc. It's not about you. It's about her. Or about him. A mere 5 minute talk, if pride and selfishness are removed, can do wonders. It really can. Scripture says, Philippians 2:3, let nothing be done through strife or vainglory, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than themselves. It's not about you, it's about your spouse. Focus on your spouse. This is another huge point. Purify your mind. Now, I'm not just talking about the things you think of. Remember, I told you I was setting up with this stereotype thing? You have beliefs in your mind that ruin your marriage. And I'm pleading with you to get rid of those things. Because that schema in your mind, as psychologists call it, drives and steers your interpretation of what happens. You interpret the things he or she does in the relationship by this roadmap in your mind, these beliefs. And half of them are nonsense and false. They in turn lead you to misinterpret what happens in the relationship. And that misinterpretation makes you have ill thoughts and feelings to your spouse that have no reason to be there. We need to reprogram our minds. Now I'm going to give you a few examples today. So I'm going to now speak only to ladies. Gentlemen, don't listen. Don't answer. Don't raise your hands. Don't say a single word, please. I'm only speaking to ladies. Ladies, I have a question for you, and I have two possible answers, and I'd like you to vote by show of hands, and I'll lead it so that it's not chaos, to see what how you'd answer this question. So here we go. Why does someone profess love early in their relationship? So picture this. A brand new relationship just begins. It's barely a week or so old, and all of a sudden, the guy in the relationship says to you, I love you. First time it's ever spoken, and you're thinking, we barely know each other. We've had 1.5 dates. Why would he? Now, why do you think the general man would do this? A, to promote commitment in the relationship, or B, to promote sexual activity in the relationship. Now, ladies, all of you that say, generally speaking, A is the right answer. Let me see your hands. We only have two. All of you that say B is the correct answer, let me see your hands. Now. Ladies, I'm done speaking to you for a little while. No answer. No show of hands, nothing. I'm speaking to the gentleman. Gentlemen, you just met this lady. Brand new relationship. You've only been on 1.5 dates. And all of a sudden she looks you in the eye and says, I love you. Why do you think the general lady would say so? A, to promote commitment in the relationship. Or B, to promote sexual activity in the relationship. Now, gentlemen, by show of hands, how many of you think A is the correct answer? How many of you think B is the correct answer? Now, what has just happened here? We have the exact same scenario with the exact same questions. Ladies, it's fair to say over 90%, said that the reason men would do so is B. Men, on the other hand, fair to say, about 90% or whatever, believed that it's A. Now, this comes from a genuine psychological academic study. They polled hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of couples and asked them this exact question. And the result of the experiment was exactly the same as what happened here. The ladies thought the men just want sex. And the men thought, she just wants to hook me. She just wants a commitment. When that part of the experiment was over, so here's how it works. The student would go to a couple, a new couple. You guys are a couple, new couple. And ask this question, sir, what do you think the general ladies out there, if a lady were to do that, what do you think they'd say? And the answers came out as we just experienced. When we're done with that, the next question would be, if you're that man that said that, what would be your reason? And then they do the same with the ladies. And guess what happens? The research shows the exact reverse. That the men who do this genuinely wanted to elevate the level of commitment. Was not to get into bed. And vice versa. And so there's a big difference here. But what I mean is that prior to this, we have stereotypes in our minds about the other gender that are negative. And when we ask the question, which one is it for you? The research shows that they did not have the wrong one in mind. So we believe stereotypes that are not true. This stereotypes changes our interpretation of what happens. Because let's say this happens in reality, and it is the first and a half date. And he leans over and he says, I love you. What happens next? She, if she uses the stereotype, says, I'm done with this guy. All he wants is to get me into bed. When in actual fact, he wanted to have the relationship progress. These stereotypes change the way we see each other, and they're quite often very negative and wrong. And so that's what the answers were, but as I say, it then changes. So, ladies, I'm just speaking to you. Gentlemen, no answer. Ladies, which gender has more positive views towards marriage? So if you were to, ladies, I'm just speaking to ladies. If I were to ask you, generally, not your relationship, generally, do men or women think more favorably about marriage? What would you say? I see a lot of woman hands, right? Well, guess what? We do exactly the same thing. We then ask the next question. Well, in your case, how do you feel about marriage? And guess what the men say? They have a very positive view of marriage. Very positive. And yet, women think men don't want to commit. Let me just tell you, that stereotype comes from the fact that there are some men who have commitment issues. And those issues are quite severe, and that has stigmatized most men. But most men don't have that issue at all. Now, for those of you that have attended some of my marriage seminars, where I actually spend an hour just on some of these topics, some of these experiments really will shock you. Do you know that men, in most relationships, say, I love you before the woman? By 64%. Ask yourself, in your relationship, who said I love you first? 64.7%. So, what I'm trying to prove to you is that we have stereotypes in your mind, negative, about the opposite sex. That stereotype guides how you interpret what happens. Get rid of them. They're ruining and negatively impacting your relationship. Next question. Which gender has lower levels of commitment in marriage? The general answers are men do. Well, the research shows that that's not true. It doesn't show women low. It shows them within a half a percent of each other. Which gender has high levels of infidelity? Now many people will say men. Men sleep around. But just think. Let me just ask a counter question. Who do you think he's sleeping with? Right? For every man that sleeps around, there's a woman sleeping around. Right, but if she knows he's married, she's still doing wrong. The research shows, and all of this is from academic studies, I can give you all references, etc. The research shows that there's actually very high levels of fidelity in marriage. It's not common for everybody to just sleep around. Before marriage in today's society, yes. But after marriage, it is not acceptable to sleep around, even for unbelievers. The statistics are actually quite high. And yet, without thinking, when I ask you these questions, we immediately peg which gender is guilty, when the statistics and the research shows that it's not really the case. National Geographic did a very interesting study a few years ago. They went to a high school, promised anonymity, used codes for people, and basically asked for the names of every single person you've slept with. This is high school. They then charted with lines to connect. It was a maze. A maze. And they had the little genders, so that you just had a gender dot with a male or a female, and then all the lines that person slept with. It was a double spread. I don't know how many seen it in National Geographic. And if you look at that, it's pretty clear. It's not just one gender sleeping around. In fact, there were many females that have multiple males who did not sleep around. And I'm not throwing the ladies under the bus. I'm just saying that the stereotypes we have of each other, the negative stereotypes, are often wrong and unsubstantiated simply by what we think, when it's not really the case. Believing these things will impact your relationship negatively. Purify your mind. If you think something bad or negative, etc., discuss it. Ask. Find out the truth before you accept it as fact. Proverbs says, "For as he thinks in his heart, so is he." Do not think for a minute that all these thoughts don't impact you. The stuff you dwell on begins to change and impact who you become, who you are. It's biblical, it's not me. So be careful thinking these negative things, because before long, if you believe it to be true, it will affect you as though it is true, even though it might be false. That's a psychological fact. If you believe something to be true, it affects you as though it is true, even if it is false. It changes you. Next step. Be positive. Just be positive. Here's the deal. Our beliefs become self-fulfilling prophecies. So, if you are in a certain culture, let's go back to New Testament times. In New Testament times, the Jews believed that it is 100% impossible for a man to withstand a woman. Therefore, if there was adultery, the woman's at fault, not the man. He can't help it. He can't withstand her. If you grow up believing that, A, and B, the second part of this belief is, if a man find themselves in total privacy, something will happen. Now, if you're a young little Jew boy, and you grow up with this, and you believe it to be fact, I cannot withstand her, and if we're alone, something will happen. That's why they were always chaperoned, etc., which is not allowed. Now, but if you grow up and you believe this, what do you think is going to happen if by some chance you find yourself with opportunity in total privacy with a young lady? What do you think is going to happen? You're going to do it because I can't withstand her. And if we find ourselves together, something will happen. Well, so let's let it happen. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so when you think these negative things all the time, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy where you, well, okay, that's the way it is. So then that's the way it is. And then it starts happening. You start doing that. So be positive. Why not let the positive things become self-fulfilling prophecy instead of the negative things? Solomon. And by the way, many of these texts come from Solomon. And I'll have you know, as far as woman goes, he's the most experienced man out there. A merry heart does good like a medicine, but a broken spirit dries the bones. Be positive. Be happy. It's healing. It really is healing. It heals the soul. It heals all sorts of ailments of negativity, etc. There are some psychological therapies where they actually have people just every day write down things they're grateful for. And it has a powerful effect on them. Because a merry heart is like a medicine. Next step. Interpret life correctly. Now, this one hinges on the previous step. Because if you don't purify your mind and you believe falsehoods that are negative as truth, it will change the way you interpret life. And the way you interpret life shapes your relationship. So we have to learn how to interpret life correctly. So let me throw some things out there. Your spouse works overtime. Why? How do you interpret that? She works overtime all of the time. How do you interpret that? Now, husband one might say, I'm in trouble. She'd rather be at work than with me. And you start thinking all sorts of negative things. You start interpreting why she's doing it, the motive, negatively. Husband two, the exact same scenario, says, oh, this wife of mine really loves me. She knows our finances are tough and she's putting in extra time to help our finances. The same situation is interpreted twice. And the fact is, we cannot read each other's minds. You don't always know the motives in your spouse's heart. You just don't know. But you think you do because we human beings interpret everything that happens. In fact, psychologically speaking, it drives us nuts if we can't make sense of something. So we interpret everything. We want to make sense of everything. So we interpret without necessarily knowing for sure. That interpretation shapes your marriage. It can make it or it can break it. It is that powerful. Scenario two. Your spouse is seen with an opposite gender at an hotel. What is happening? Well, yes, spouse one can say she's planning a surprise birthday party for me. Spouse two will say this marriage is over. But you have no more facts. And yet we interpret as though we do. Purify your mind. Interpret life correctly. And if you can't interpret it, ask. Without having evil thoughts. Ask without accusation. And of course, you've got to get to know your spouse. There's got to be trust. And those type of things. But interpret life correctly. Don't jump to the negative interpretations. She has a headache. Again. And so you assume automatically that she just doesn't want to be intimate with you. She's faking a headache. Has it ever come to your mind that she could have a genuine headache? Again. Many people have frequent headaches. What about the reverse? She wants to talk, but he claims to be too tired. Now, some ladies would interpret, he doesn't want to talk to me. He doesn't want to have emotional intimacy with me. By the way, men, please understand that women measure the closeness and depth of relationships by secrets shared. The deeper, more intimate, and the more frequent you share secrets with her, the closer she thinks you are to her. Women punish by exclusion. So, when she has this need to talk, she wants to share secrets and so forth that bonds the two of you. Just like the lady can have a genuine headache. Ladies, please understand, men sometimes are too tired. And you'd say, but wait a minute, you don't look tired to me. Look at what you just did, etc. You've got energy to do such and such. Please understand, when he says he's too tired, it doesn't always refer to physically being too tired. Mental energy. All I'm trying to say is, when he says he's too tired, accept. He's not an excuse. He's tired. When she says she's got a headache, don't start thinking, oh, well, she's a... Accept. She's got a headache. It happens. Interpret life correctly. I can give you hundreds of scenarios, but you get the point. In my office, I have a little... For those of you that have attended my parenting seminars and so forth will know, I have this thing in my office. On my drawer, my credenza thing. And it says, 20% IQ, intelligence, quotient, how smart you are, plus 80% EQ, emotional intelligence, equals 100% success quotient, provided you're honest and working and so forth. What this means is that only 20% of your smarts contribute to your success level. 80% of your success in life actually comes from EQ, not IQ. I haven't told faculty, right? Ooh. Okay. So very shortly, you all know of a genius that works at work. He knows the job inside out. He's brilliant, beyond brilliant. But he doesn't get promoted. He doesn't have success in life. Doesn't have friends. Isn't fulfilled. Why? Nobody can work with him. He doesn't have EQ. And then, of course, you know about the office drama person because of low EQ. Might be brilliant at the job, but nobody can get along with her. Nobody can work with her, etc. And then, of course, you know the reverse. This employee is just mediocre, just plain mediocre, but gets all the promotions. Why? Because everybody loves the person and get the person, etc. It's all about EQ. Here comes the good news and the bad news. IQ cannot be taught. With neuroplasticity of the brain, the brain can create new pathways, etc., and can develop intelligence later in life as well. But it's a long, tedious, repetitive process. EQ, on the other hand, is easily teachable. And yet, we spend all our money, resources, time, from elementary school right through doctoral level at university, trying to build 20%. And we spend not a single class on EQ. Now, I'm talking about work. Let's transition to marriage. Low EQ ruins your marriage. Because low EQ, one of the telltale signs of low EQ is misinterpretation of life. Plain and simple. I'm talking to my brother here. at work. And so as I'm speaking about him, you're my co-worker, and you come walking down the passageway, and when you get a certain distance, we stop talking. And you walk by, and when you're out of earshot, we start talking again. Now, the person with low EQ walks by and jumps to the conclusion with no proof at all. The reason they stop talking, I'm interpreting life, I'm trying to make sense of what happened. The reason they stop talking is because they're talking about me. And they're talking badly about me. They're sharing negativity about me. They don't like me. And now tomorrow, I don't greet them because they don't like me. I don't work with them because they're my enemy. Why didn't they come to me? Now, is that interpretation of life correct? Not necessarily. Who says? Who says? I could have been telling him about some private medical issue as my friend that I'm suffering. That's none of your business. We could have been discussing some work thing that doesn't relate to you that you shouldn't know. It's not about you. And yet, we jump to these conclusions that negatively impact relationships, and in marriage it's exactly the same. Your spouse does something or says something and you interpret it wrongly. You need to learn to interpret life correctly and to have a mindset that thinks in the right way. There are tons, hundreds of books out because it's a hot topic right now for the last 3, 4, 5 years on emotional intelligence. You can buy these books and work through them and teach yourself and actually dramatically increase your EQ. It will greatly contribute to your life success, both in marriage as well as at work. Make sure you interpret life correctly. This is a prayer conference, right? Here are the points that we've spoken about today. Change yourself, not your spouse. How we fight is more important than what we fight about. Work on your marriage. It's not about you, it's about your spouse. Purify your mind, get rid of all these negative things. Be positive, interpret life right. Prayer is one of the only activities where you actually do all of that in one activity. Think about it for a minute. When you pray for your spouse, are you going to say things like, Lord, bring under my power. When you pray, you rather pray, Lord, change me. Right? How we fight, Lord, give me patience. Give me kindness. Calm my temper. When you pray for your spouse, you're actually working on your marriage. When you pray for your spouse, it's not about you, it's about them. And even when you pray for yourself, it's not to gain control on things, it's to pray for God to make you more like Him. Pray for a pure mind. Praying does that because what you pray is going to be biblical. Prayer is by nature positive. Even when you face negative situations, you pray for resolution. Pray. Prayer helps you to interpret life wrong. Lord, perhaps it was too mean of me to hear like that. It changes your interpretation. Prayer has a huge impact. Now, listen to Dr. Full. In his best-selling book, Relationship Rescue, he's quoting somebody else, and he says, an interesting statistic shared by David McLaughlin in his wonderful series entitled The Role of the Man in the Family reflects that the divorce rate in America is at a minimum 1 out of 2 marriages, 50%. By the way, that statistic is not quite right because it includes second and third marriages, which has a higher rate. The rate of first marriages is actually lower, but let's leave it at that. But the reported divorce rate among couples that pray together is about 1 in 10,000. Pretty impressive statistic, even if you reduce it a thousandfold. Now, let me first of all say that this statistic is false. There has never been a study done of such magnitude to get to this. Because to prove this, 1 in 10,000, you'll have to have millions in your study for it to be statistically valid. And a study like this has never, ever been done. And you'll have to track these people for a lifetime. Because I know people that have been married over 50 years that got divorced. So I can categorically say to you that I think this guy is dreaming a bit. From an academic, psychological point of view, this is not provable. There's never been a study that proves this. However, there has been numerous studies published in academic journals, done by secular organizations, government organizations, etc. And all of these studies say that there is a significant improvement in divorce rates with couples that pray for each other. Significant. It's not 1 in 10,000, the divorce rate, but it depends on what study. There's even one study that claims 1 in 39,000, but of course that's even worse. But seriously, this topic has been studied scientifically, academically, numerous times with a lot of people. And couples who pray for each other, their divorce rate is so much lower than those who don't. Bring God into the marriage, into the relationship. Let God help you to become who you need to be. Let God shape your spouse, not you. Let God change your view and your mind. Why am I saying this? God already knows what we're going to pray for before we pray. So why did he dream up the idea of prayer? Prayer changes you. Prayer has a huge impact on you. When you verbalize things, it has a very good psychological effect on you. How many of you in school, because this happened to me all the time, you're in school and you're struggling with science or math. You just don't get it. And no matter how long you try, you just don't get it. And eventually you raise your hand and the teacher says, yes. And you start explaining what you don't understand. And about halfway through your explanation, never mind, I've got it. Ever happened to you? When you verbalize things, it has an effect upon your brain. That's why even talking to an animal is good therapy. It really is. Verbalizing things helps you to make sense of it, helps you to process it, etc. So when it comes to prayer, God designed prayer not just for himself because he wants us to speak to him, even though he wants that. But in addition to that, prayer is designed for you. It changes you. Think of what it does in your marriage. Prayer keeps you humble. I've never heard of anybody that prays, Lord, you must be so lucky to have a guy like me. Prayer makes you humble. Prayer releases deep hurts. Prayer leads to forgiveness, something that is mightily needed in marriage. Prayer leads to acceptance of each other. Prayer unites us. Prayer leads to appreciation and thankfulness. I pray every single day of my life, I thank the Lord for my wife. I thank him for giving her to me. Every day of my life. Praying that makes me thankful to have her. Now, how does that change the way I see her and how I deal with her? It has a huge impact on life. Prayer helps us to submit to God. Prayer invites God to change us. Prayer removes selfishness. Prayer provides hope. I can continue with this list for another 10 minutes. Prayer in your marriage is vital. Prayer in your life is vital. Now, when people drive, a lot of people when they drive listen to seminars and audiobooks and tapes and Bible, etc. And I do all of that as well. But one of my favorite things to do is to spend that time praying. Now, please don't stone me. I know some of you might think that's disrespectful towards God or blasphemy, etc. You're entitled to the way I'm not trying to change your view. But for me, I spend hours in prayer when I drive. Every day when I drive to work, there's no radio on, there's nothing on. I spent that time in prayer, communing God, asking Him to prepare me for the day, asking Him for whatever challenge I'm going to face, pray for my wife, my marriage, my kids, whatever else. Because there's so much time available to us if we double task. Without adding hours to the day, you can pray when you drive. It's just one example. But what I'm saying is, prayer is vital to your marriage. Not just from a religious point of view. Remember all those studies done by governments, done by universities, secular places. Prayer has a huge impact on marriage. Has a huge impact on your life. Pray, pray, pray. And it's not just prayer on other things. Pray for your spouse. Pray for your marriage. Pray for the struggles you're having. Pray about that. Because that is part of working on your marriage. Let's end with prayer. Lord, we thank You so much for giving us the spouses we have. Lord, some people are not happy about that at all. But I pray that You will change them. Lord, I pray that You will give them happiness and joy and fulfillment. As Your servant, Mrs. White, wrote, that it's like heaven. Lord, I thank You that You use marriage to equate and to explain Your relationship to us throughout Scripture. I thank You that we could have somebody to just share life with, everything. Please take hold of our marriages and make it what You want it to be. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.